Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. More than 6 million children in the United States have been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or commonly known as ADHD. Some identify as just ADD, attention deficit disorder, without the hyperactivity. Either way, it is a brain disorder that may begin in childhood and persist throughout a person's life. And throughout life, the strategies for treating ADD and ADHD change. Joining us today is ADHD expert, psychologist, and author of the book, I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not, Successful Living with ADD and ADHD, Wes Crenshaw. Welcome back, Wes.
And when I'm here with you, I don't want to be anywhere else, Ann.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Listen, we always love to take calls during an hour with Wes Crenshaw. So if you have a question or comment about ADD or ADHD, adult, your child, whatever it is, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, it says 6 million children have been diagnosed, Wes Crenshaw, but it affects so many more people, parents, teachers, family members, siblings, the whole thing.
Yeah, I was going to be super cool and be able to quote back to you the number of adults diagnosed, and that number actually does not exist. I could not find a statistic on that because we have so many people who we can't track that information. And then there's a whole bunch of other people who probably have ADD that aren't diagnosed. Mm-hmm. So that's, mm-hmm. We know the kids, we don't know, but it's millions and millions of adults too. Mm-hmm.
So what, let's talk about the difference between ADD and ADHD. I think it's really important. You must too, because you put it in the title of your book.
Yeah. This is the worst branding, I always say, of any thing you can imagine. It's like when they made New Coke, you know, it didn't turn out very well. And we used to have ADD with hyperactivity and ADD without hyperactivity. And then back in the DSM-3R, right after I got out of graduate school back in the 90s, they made it all ADHD. And so what's really frustrating for people is you'll say, well, I think you have ADHD. And I'm like, well, I'm not hyperactive. And so you now diagnose it as ADHD without hyperactivity. Activity or primarily inattentive type, in other words, which is sort of like ordering, you know, a quesadilla without the cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And it's confusing for people, but so I just tend to call it ADD and ADHD.
Are more people diagnosed, or what is your understanding about how many people are ADHD versus ADD alone?
It is the vast majority, particularly in adults, are ADD. And those who have hyperactivity, it's typically expressed differently than it is in children. You know, you don't typically see an adult running around like as if driven by a motor, which uh-huh. is one of the criteria. And so we really had hoped in the DSM-5, and that's
and the DSM-5
yeah,
is, yeah,
I knew, I,
jargon.
I knew the minute I said
yeah,
it.
Stop
the,
it.
The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is put out by the American Psychiatric Association.
The Bible.
Yeah. And a year ago, it went into effect, the new version went from 4 to 5. And in the 5, we had really had this, like, I guess, hallucination that we were going to have better diagnostic criteria for adults, and really they're the same as they were in the 4 with just some very minor changes. So we're still a little bit handicapped by what was originally a child's diagnosis and uh-huh. trying to diagnose adults.
Why is diagnosing, whether it's ADD or ADHD, why is it so complicated? You can't do a pinprick test, right?
No, exactly. And you can't really, you know, despite what a couple of fairly famous experts say about this, there's not really cross-validated research to say that you can put somebody on a PET scan and see not only that they have ADHD, but what kind they have and all of that. That's really not proven in good research. So you're really having to do it based on the self-report of the individual.
Right. So who's qualified then to diagnose it? Because self-reporting, particularly among children, has got to be difficult.
Qualified, boy, that got Bernie Sanders into trouble earlier in the year, didn't it? Qualified is a tricky thing because anybody who's qualified to diagnose is qualified to do it. So a medical doctor, a counselor who's licensed to practice, a psychotherapist. But the real question is who is really the best to do that? And the vast majority of ADHD in our country for adults and for a lot of kids is diagnosed by primary care physicians or pediatricians. And it's usually based on a very cursory discussion in the office. Maybe I know people who were diagnosed in 8 minutes. because that's about how long they met with their physician. So we don't actually recommend doing that.
Okay.
We really think it's better to go to somebody, and there are people in every city in the country who are specialized in the assessment. Now, I will warn folks, if you go in and somebody says, yes, I can do this, it's going to cost you about $1,200, and I've seen it happen.
That is overkill. Okay.
That's too expensive.
Okay.
Unless you have some other neurological concerns or the someone else professional has felt you do, memory, very difficult memory problems, or there's concern about core IQ or something else, that shouldn't cost that much. It should be maybe a tenth of that amount, because the testing isn't complex. It's just important. And the testing that should be done is what's called standardized testing, which means you're not just checking off a list. You're being compared to persons of your gender and age to see how you differ from them, because that's what diagnosis is, that you're different.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about ADD and ADHD today. We've done it before. It is springtime now, and a lot of kids are graduating from high school, getting ready to make the big leap to college or maybe a full-time job of some type. That's a lot of struggle for a lot of people who have ADD or ADHD. So I'd like to hear from people who have questions and comments, of course, but I'd really like to hear from people who have made that leap now and have had a very structured approach to it, or at least a strategy that they embraced to approach college, because it's scary for a lot of people, and not just the people with ADD and ADHD, but also their parents, family members, that kind of a thing. A lot of people are concerned. 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page. You can post your question or comment there. Wes Crenshaw, boys are diagnosed three times as often as girls. Some skeptics think that boys are overdiagnosed because it's a way to keep them from just being boys.
Yeah, this is really a complicated one. First of all, the reason more boys are diagnosed is because they tend to be more externalizers. They tend to be the more demonstratively hyperactive. Now, the question is whether girls have the same rate of hyperactivity, but it's more internal. Maybe they're fidgety. Maybe they just always, you know, want to do what they're not doing, and they feel this internal restlessness. But at the very least, we know for externalizing, boys are much more likely to be socially and cognitively the actor-outers.
Is that then saying that it's just easier to diagnose
yes.
them? So they're more often diagnosed.
Yes.
It's not that they necessarily are more likely.
Yeah. And as for overdiagnosis, I always say this is really not a thing. We know for a fact there's a bunch of people who are not getting diagnosed because we see them frequently coming through at all ages. What the problem is that it's not overdiagnosis, it's bad diagnosis. It's not sufficient attention paid to the history, to the first-order relatives, whether folks have had this up the family tree. Just a lot of things to look at that take you, you know, it takes us about 2 hours in our office to three seeing someone to do the testing and to do the really good interview. And that's where the idea of overdiagnosis comes from.
It's called attention deficit disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. There's a stigma associated with that. Is it often the same way that there's a stigma associated with mental illness? I'm wondering, what's the difference between a disorder and a mental illness?
Okay, so there's kind of two.
And the stigma.
Yeah, let's talk about the stigma for a second, because it's really annoying. I think that people have done way better with just about every other psychological disorder than ADD. There is this weird suspicion about ADD, and you see it in just all the time, that the ADD people are somehow they're cheating, or they're tricking us, or they're drug seeking, or they're making it up, or they just ought to get up and do what needs to be done. And I got two of them at home. I got one out here in the hall that are my children, and I can guarantee you they're not faking it. And so there is this stigma that it's just this over, even saying it's overdiagnosed is sort of telling a bunch of people, you're just making it up. And so I think it's particularly problematic with ADD, that stigma being attached.
And then what about the disorder versus a mental illness?
Well,
there must be a clinical distinction.
There really is not.
Okay.
It was a good shot, Ian.
Okay.
Try again. No, in order to get treatment for anything, and you got to kind of remember, this is a controversial thing to say, but the DSM-5 that we talked about a moment ago is really an economic document. There are people that build a shrine to it and worship it as if it really is true, and it isn't. It's just a way of, you know, calling people names. But we have to call them names like depressed and bipolar or whatever in order to do one critical thing, and that's get paid to see them. This is the same thing that your physician does if they're going to treat your throat infection. They've got to call you something. And so they say you have, you know, tonsillitis or something.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to have those designations, and that is what a disorder is. It is a human construct, a way to talk about people and label them, but necessarily. Now, in my book, I talk about the ADD people and the leaners, and I believe there are people who really either lean one way or the other. They tend to lean towards the anxious side or they lean towards the ADD side. And that doesn't mean they have enough criteria or enough impairment, which is critical impairment, mm-hmm. to be diagnosed. It just means that's kind of their tendency. And those are the folks who, you know, just kind of need to know themselves. They don't necessarily need to have an active treatment. So
gotcha.
That's where the threshold is. It's the level of impairment.
Are there ever any breakthroughs in treatment or in explaining where it comes from? We know, I mean, Ritalin, for instance, in treating ADD or ADHD goes back to the 70s.
Oh, no, back to the 50s.
Okay, goes back to the 50s.
Both of the main stimulants go clear back to the 50s.
And there are other kinds along the way and other mm-hmm. drugs. But are there any big breakthroughs?
Well, that's a good question. In terms of medicine, though, the two core elements of all treatment for ADD, which are – you mentioned Ritalin and then the other is Adderall. Those are their brand names.
Mm-hmm.
Both of the ingredients for that go back to the 50s, and the only thing that's changed up till this year is how you get that into people's system.
Okay.
So there have been added the Daytrona patch, which you stick on yourself, which is just Ritalin on a sticky, and there is Vyvanse, which is essentially the same thing bonded in a way to a molecule so that it doesn't turn into a stimulant until it's into your system. So there's just kind of different ways to make it easier. There's a little bit different mixtures. There's a new medicine called Evikio, but all that is a different mixture of amphetamines. And our goal, and again, I am not a pharmacist, but our goal in treatment with medicines is to have the maximum benefit with the minimum side effect. And we're actually – my nurse practitioner and I are doing a book for next year called ADD and Zombies. And it's going to be about the best practices for medicine therapy integration treatments.
There is no cure for ADHD or ADD.
No, not really. Occasionally, yeah, there may be a percentage of people, perhaps up to a third, who kind of outgrow it. But that, too, is controversial, whether it's really outgrowing the neurological condition or you just get to a point where you're out of school and you don't have to have the kind of focus necessary in an academic environment.
You might be lucky enough to get a job that suits you and so you adapt.
Exactly.
Or you know yourself better.
Yeah, exactly. Or I will say, though, a lot of folks come in married couples.
Yeah.
And, you know, one partner thinks they're over this and the other partner is like, not even close.
Right. Relationships are a big issue.
We do a lot of treatment of that.
We are talking about ADD and ADHD today. My guest, Dr. Wes Crenshaw, he's a psychologist. He's an expert on the topic and author of a book. His most recent book is called I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not, Successful Living with ADD and ADHD. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you can check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. We'd like to hear from people who feel like they've have some pretty successful strategies. That's what people are always yearning for, new ideas about how to cope, how to be more successful. Who doesn't want that? Give us a call. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. ADHD does not discriminate. You could be the best parent with all the money in the world. Your child could be highly intelligent and moral. The trick is to get it diagnosed and treated. And if your ADHD or ADD doesn't coexist with another disorder such as anxiety or insomnia, you're lucky. Still with us is ADHD and ADD expert and psychologist and author of the book, I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not, Successful Living with ADD and ADHD, Wes Crenshaw. And joining us now is Christine
Kodick.
She is the coordinator for children and adults with Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder of Columbus. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
What do we know about why other mental health conditions coexist with ADHD, that is anxiety disorder? Is it along with ADHD, or does it emerge as a reaction to life with that issue? Christine Kodick, how do you see it?
I don't know that it comes as something along with it.
Is it causative or correlative?
I think
correlated?
It correlates. It's okay. Correlative. I don't think it's necessarily causative.
Yeah.
I think it's probably more correlative. Wes, you can probably speak
better
to that. Yeah,
Wes Crenshaw, what do you think?
Well, I know that the answer is yes to that question. it has been an interesting area of study. I talk a lot in the book about the existence of anxiety along with ADD because in general, people tend to lean one way or the other. But yeah, there is an overlap about 25% that lean in both directions. And these folks, and if they're listening, they will know what I mean. They are the most tortured folks you're going to run into because you've got sort of both of the difficult at the same time. You've got yourself chasing yourself around, trying to get yourself to do what you're supposed to do and being angry at yourself because yourself won't do it. And that's tough. So we don't know quite why that happens. It doesn't seem to just be that folks are anxious because of how hard ADD is, because the hardcore ADD people don't care enough about that. And that's sort of the essence of that disorder, whereas anxiety is you care too much. So.
An email from Jeremy, he asks, who should an adult who thinks they may have ADD or ADHD go to get an accurate diagnosis? Are these tests written or done through talk therapy or another way? Christine Kodick, what do you tell people?
When people come to us, we refer them to first start a lot of times with their family physician is a good place to start and then look forward to. And I feel like in Columbus, there aren't a lot of providers that are looking for that. So, but a family physician is a good starting point for that.
They're prepped at least. They know what questions to ask.
Right, and then they can look further. And I think, Wes, you talked about that a little bit earlier.
Well, I disagree a little bit in that I think the reason we have quote-unquote overdiagnosis is because they don't always do that. Now, I will say some pediatricians I've worked with are more diligent, but there is a scale called the Vanderbilt that a lot of them use, the pediatricians like. And the problem with the Vanderbilt scale is all it is a checklist and you add up the numbers. The Connors is the one we use, and there are a couple of other ones that are standardized assessments and that they compare you to a norm group so that you are a certain degree above or below the mean. And that's really the best kind of paper and pencil test. Now, the caller is also correct that there should be a talk interview with that. And we go into a lot of things that are – some of them are really obvious, like you got any relatives with ADD because that's a really high predictor. Other things are kind of odd, like how do you respond to coffee? The people with ADD a lot of times can, you know, down a pot of coffee and go take a nap just because coffee is a stimulant, hits the same receptor sites, dopamine receptor sites as stimulant medication. And so there's, the thing you mentioned earlier about insomnia. You've got to rule out which came first, the insomnia, which can lead to ADD-like symptoms, or is it what I call unofficially ADD-related insomnia, where folks with ADD don't sleep as well. And so there is really a little more complicated. And then going on to the med management, you can either help or harm all of that stuff. So you have to monitor that closely, and it becomes kind of self-diagnosing then.
And I know a lot of our adults that come to our CHAD meetings have had trouble finding someone who can give them an accurate diagnosis and who can work with medication if that's the route that they want to go, because it's not, you know, it's not like other medications.
It's not like you have diabetes, you take insulin.
Right. It's not like you have a strep throat, you take penicillin. Yeah. It's very individualized. So that can be really difficult for them. So, you know, a lot of them come and kind of network and talk with each other. We get a lot of new people who talk with those that come to our meetings that have been through that and talk with each other. So that's a great place at our CHAD meetings to find resources of people who have been through that and have good ideas of who you can go to in our area for
that. That's a good idea. Belinda in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. I first want to respond to your question about accommodations in college.
Mm-hmm.
I was a student with ADD at OSU in the 90s, and I signed up with Officer Disability Services, and they did two very important things for me. One was they let me take my tests in their office in a quiet room, and that kept anxiety down. And the second thing I did, which was very important, is I sat at the front of all of the college classrooms so that none of the young students behind me could distract me. And those two things really made it for me. But then I also have a question for you, for your panelists, and it's with ADD. I now know that I am an introvert, a little bit of an outgoing introvert, but still an introvert. And there seems to have come up a question is, if you're an introvert, maybe you don't have ADD, and I'd like to hear your panelists' questions about that, and I'll take it off the radio.
All right, Belinda. An introvert being somebody who gets sort of their energy from being alone as opposed to being in a group.
Yeah, and introversion is a right fine thing. About half the population leans in that direction. So there's really not any correlation with ADD and introversion. What's the problem that I think the caller is experienced perhaps is that if you are an introvert, you're one of those internalizers I was talking about earlier, and you're not up dancing on the desk
swinging
and singing
from the chandeliers is the way I put it.
And so it's harder to pick up on that. And I've got two or three cases right now where I struggled to figure out the diagnosis for that reason, because the person is, this really nice little sweet person, little gal who doesn't cause any trouble in school, and she says, Wes, I study 14 hours a day and I'm making A's only because of that. And so you begin to have to think, okay, what's going on here? And sure enough, we diagnosed her introverted, good student that she is, and it is an amazing difference for her in the amount of effort and the amount of learning she can do. So that's an example of what the caller is talking about.
Okay. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about ADD and ADHD today, the attention deficit disorder. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Beautifully done, Ann.
Thank you very much. Right off the top of my head. If you have a question or comment, want to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm going to turn to Arshad now in Columbus, because you think colleges don't pay enough attention to ADD needs.
Hi, Ann.
Hi,
Arshad. I'm a student at OSU currently, and when I was younger, I'm actually a first year now. When I was younger, I was considered at risk for ADHD. Turns out the hyperactivity symptoms were because of Tourette's syndrome, and I found really great institutional support at OSU, like your previous caller, Belinda. I'm also registered with ODS. I guess my question is, OSU is really at the forefront of a lot of these things. I wanted to ask about the recognition of disorders like ADD and ADHD in the workplace, because I've found great support in places I work. I worked as a tutor in at several places, and I found great accommodations for these sort of disorders. I'm wondering, how do workplaces deal with, how do they accommodate for disorders like ADD and ADHD that sort of jar your attention and have physical demonstrative effects?
Man, that is the most – that was a very dense point you made. All of that is good information. Okay, so first of all, a good example of needing to have more testing if you're not figuring it out with simple testing is if someone has Tourette's. Secondly, part of the thing with OSU is it's a big education college, and so there is a lot of a support built into this university that makes sense, because you all have such an emphasis on education. However, in other universities, one can go in, do exactly what the earlier caller said, get to the student disabilities office, which is always, there's some of them are still called student disabilities. Others are, student success or something that sounds a little more positive.
Less pejorative, right?
Yeah. And you want to get, if you can get what's called a 504. which is an educational accommodation, kind of like an IEP in schools, but it's the Section 504 of the Americans with Disabilities Act for access to education. And though it will vary, you know, from school to school, for the most part, the accommodations described earlier can be gotten pretty easily under that. And finally, in the workplace, this is true for school and the workplace. This is where it becomes critical to have a very well-documented diagnosis, preferably with testing. Mm-hmm. We have printouts that come from our system that we give to the client that shows a scale and shows how they scored out. And when we do the intake, we try to write it up in a way that can be consumed outside of our office. And that substantiates for the Americans with Disabilities Act, both in school and in the workplace. And I have written letters. We do a thing in our office where people take medication breaks about 3 times a year for reasons having to do with building tolerance to stimulant. Mm-hmm. And when they're on those breaks, which are 10 days to 2 weeks, you know, they're not the greatest employee on earth a lot of times. And so we write and provide cover for them for the Americans with Disabilities Act so that the employer is inclined to be supportive in that environment.
Yeah, so
the more you get that well documented and work with a professional, the more solid it is in the workplace and school.
You know, what about Christine Kodak? What about children and adults with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder of Columbus? When you have your talk groups and things like that, are they talking about work a lot?
They are a lot of. That's what in our support groups, a lot of people talk about work because some of them don't disclose to their employers that they have ADHD. So they're constantly in that awkward position where maybe they're late to work, maybe they're late on reports, and they're struggling with that. So it can be a big issue, and they're trying to figure out. So we a lot of times will have people come in from the state and talk about how they can go about handling that and talking with their employers and what the legal ramifications for them are and how best to do that. So that's something that we try to support people because that's a big issue for adults as you're trying to work that out. And I'm talking about adults in their 50s and 60s that are just getting diagnosed and trying to understand what that means for them, because that's a big thing to understand. Wow, this is what's going on here. How do I understand this, and how can I make this work for me? This is a big deal.
You know, when someone's in their 50s or even their 60s and they're getting diagnosed, I think about an event when I first got my kid glasses. And he put the glasses on. He said, "It feels like I'm seeing the world in high definition, or HD is the way he put it. I'm wondering what it's like to be medicated then at the age of 50 or 60 and have the medication be effective, what that must be like.
Yeah, it is. Let's say I've used that exact description with people who wear glasses who know that experience.
You know what that experience, yeah. Yep.
And if you – particularly with medications, it ought to kind of be like that. Mm-hmm. It should be, if you are correctly diagnosed and the medicine is correct, it ought to be like, oh my gosh, is this how the normal people think? and kind of you do see the world that way. And at this age – and I am 53, so I have some empathy for the folk in that range – I will get people through who've kind of hit their Waterloo, and we do even a more thorough assessment because there are other things at this point that can be coming into play. But if you will typically see a surprising history of work failure or school failure or failure to achieve goals that the person is cognitively capable of achieving. So you see it there. It just wasn't diagnosed.
Arshad, thanks for that call. I'm going to turn now to Lynn in Dayton. You were diagnosed with ADD at age 45. Welcome to the show.
Actually, no, I was diagnosed, as I was telling your screener, I was diagnosed at age 7. I'm now 45.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was diagnosed back in the Stone Ages of this, in 1977, so to speak, when I underwent a barrage of tests, including dietary allergen testing, a week of testing at a neurologist, and then when I got to the University of Georgia, I had to be re-evaluated by the University of Georgia for 3 or 4 days as well. But I have a question about correlation between another issue that kind of really impacts as well, and I wanted to know about the prevalence of it. I don't remember the scientific name for it, but I am also what they would call mind's eye blind. So I have no mind's eye as well. Have you heard of any correlation between that affliction. And then, along with learning disability prevalence, and also maybe you can comment on why is it that it went from such an extreme of being this massive barrage of tests to 8 minutes in a doctor's office now sometimes. But I'm very curious about the Mind's Eye Blind, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name, and I didn't have time to look it up again.
Okay. All right. Lynn, thanks a lot.
That'd make a great album for Jimi Hendrix.
Mind's Eye Blind.
I actually do not know that one. I know the second half of the answer, and that is you're right on the money. For the longest time, you know, it used to be ADD was called minimal brain dysfunction, which it honestly is kind of a better name for it. It is a neurological condition. But that goes back many years, and I'm just now, because of the book, I've taken a small number of folks in their 50s and 60s who were diagnosed early in life and have always been on medicine and been treated, and they're an interesting bunch. But the amount of testing that was believed necessary was to rule out all these other things that were thought to have a cause, food allergies being among them. The research has never supported that unless you have another disorder like celiacs perhaps that is mimicking some of the symptoms of ADD. That does exist, or you have another neurological condition. So, you know, they did this for years and years. What we've learned now is that really is overkill, that you can get down to just this set of symptoms and have a pretty good hit rate if you really do study the person's behavior and listen to what they're saying and give them the testing. You can figure it out without all of the rigmarole that caller understandably
went
through.
Sure. Yeah. Lynn, thanks a lot for that call. You know, Christine Kotick, do people talk about meds a lot?
They do. They do. They talk about whether they should, from parents to the adults that come and everything, whether they should take them, whether they should not take them. You have a lot of parents who don't want their children to take them. So they talk about other things they can do. You have a lot of talk about what different kinds of things they can do besides take medication. So there's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of questions. There's a lot of things. And, you know, and I think there's a lot of parents that struggle, parents that struggle to find the right medication for their child, because you do have the pediatricians that just throw out a medication quickly, and it's the first thing because that's what they always give, and it's a process, and it can be very difficult, and not everybody understands that. You know, you said before, it's not like diabetes where you can easily titrate or whatever the proper medical term is. You know, it's not the same, so it can be very difficult. So there is a lot of talk, and then there's some parents who just, they don't want that. They want other options, and there are things that you can work on and tools that you can work on with children and with adults to work on things. So there's definitely a lot of talk about medication.
We'll talk about some of that when we return. You just heard from Christine Kotick. She's coordinator for children and adults with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder of Columbus. Also with me in the studio, Dr. Wes Crenshaw. He's a psychologist, and his book is he's author of the book, I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not, Successful Living with ADD and ADHD. We'll get to more calls when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When left untreated, ADD or ADHD can cause problems in school and work. There is no cure, but treatment is available. That's what we're talking about today. Still with us is ADHD expert and psychologist and author of the book, I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not, Successful Living with ADD and ADHD, Wes Crenshaw. And also with us in the studio, Christine Kotick. She is the coordinator for children and adults with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder of Columbus. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's always lots of questions about medication. That's the thing we have most. We have an email from Carl who asks if the panel could discuss any new exciting non-medication treatments. It is now advised that they be utilized first rather than medication. I don't know about that. I guess it sort of depends on who's doing the advising. But Wes Crenshaw, what about medication and how many different kinds are out there?
Well, at the risk of being reductive, too, they're really, you know, I've met one person that did well on the non-stimulant Strattera, but not very often. And the most common one at this point is Vyvanse. That's the amphetamine, kind of new wave amphetamine one. And then there's a variety of Ritalin medicines. Most of those are now generic because they've been around so long.
Serotonins?
You mean the serotonin reuptake inhibitors?
Yeah.
Those are typically what you want for anxiety.
Okay.
And if anything, one of the problems with diagnosis on that is we have an excellent nurse practitioner we work closely with. That actually can make you more ADD because it reduces your anxiety, and those two things tend to work in hydraulic fashion. And that does bring us to kind of follow up Christine's point earlier. Really, the best thing you can do if you're going to do the recommended integrative treatment is to have a close treatment team that is a therapist trained to do evaluation and treatment tightly interwoven with your prescriber, because the dialogue necessary to understand medicine is an ongoing process, particularly in children as they age and change. And we've really worked hard to perfect that. We have a very, very high satisfaction rate in our clinic with medication management because we form a team and we put the person taking the medicine at the head of the team, whether they're 7 years old or 70 years old. So we're really honoring their experience of that and trying to make it the best it can be. And that really helps with compliance and satisfaction with medicine.
Do groups like the one Christine Kotick has been talking about, how people they talk, they have talk groups, that kind of a thing. Is that helpful when people are sharing stories and comparing notes?
You know, I think so. I think it also helps with socialization,
yeah,
and really learning.
Kind of normalizing.
Yeah, and learning how to interact with each other. You know, many folks with ADD, and not all of them, but many miss social cues because they're caught up in other stimulus. And if you can get a group of people together who can kind of call each other on that, which is what group process can be good at, and kind of teach each other how to do that in an environment where everybody's dealing with the same stuff, yeah, that can be pretty helpful. Mm.
Email from a listener. Do your guests have any ideas on simple advice we can give our ADHD children when they are eager to develop deeper relationships with their peers but just don't know how to do it? For example, they say, I don't know what to say to them. I don't like to play what they're playing, etc. Christine Kotick, people must talk about that.
Yeah, that's always tough. That's tough even when you don't have
ADHD.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's just a tough growing up thing. And it's just sometimes it's modeling that with kids. And that's always a good thing, and working with that. And so having a play date and trying to be involved with your kid and child and having them work together and saying, you know, let's see how, you know, how can we do this together, and, you know, invite the child over and practice that with them and kind of give them the words that they can use, but then encouraging them to do that themselves. What I find as I work with kids is parents get anxious for their children and they start doing it for them. And then you get kids that in eighth grade and ninth grade that don't know how to do it because parents want so badly for it to happen for their child. And then it becomes very it just becomes not good for the child because the mom and dad have stepped in so often and they're wanting to help. So, you know, giving your child the tools to do that and helping them kind of advocate, whether it's with the teacher, that's not the social setting, but, uh-huh, you know, so giving them the tools to do that, giving,
yeah,
them the words.
Because by the time it's college time, if mom and dad have been doing everything for the kid, Wes Crenshaw, they,
yeah,
haven't developed any strategies for themselves.
Well, it's absolutely true. My daughter is now a sophomore in college and a 4.0 student, and I'm still teaching her how to drive, which is just one of many examples of doing a lot for kids and then them not developing those skills. I will say, on the other hand, one of the things we understand for young folks with ADD is they're about 2.5 to 3 years behind developmentally. And I hope everyone underlines what I just said, because it's so critical. So I have to think about my daughter as more of a 16-year-old who would be learning to drive than a 19-year-old. And I have to think that's how her social skills are and so on and so on. That doesn't – you know, I hate to say they're immature because that's always such a pejorative term. But they just are evolving more slowly, and that will tend to always be true. So without condescending to your kids, you do have to kind of honor their little bit earlier developmental level and do more for them and encourage them strongly to do more for themselves.
There's so many calls. Derek and Pataskala, you're on the air. Hi, Derek.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Sorry about this.
That's okay.
I'm not ready.
Well, you wanted to talk about how your high school has accommodated you.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went to ACBA. I don't know if you guys have covered it, but I know NPR has covered them in general.
What's this?
ACBA, the Arts and College Prep Academy.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
They did a wonderful job of accommodating. They understood that it takes longer for kids with ADHD to grasp stuff. And I think sometimes all kids need is patience, just a little bit of patience to help understand stuff.
Another model that works but is hard to find a college that does, there are a few of them, is rather than taking regular semesters or even trimesters, what we have found with a lot of the ADD kids is they do better in summer school. And you're like, what in the world? Summer school is brutal. Well, no. What happens is you got 6 to 8 weeks worth of courses. You're taking one course. Boom, they're done. And by the time they're sick of it, it's over. And so if you that is one model that's probably better suited to folks with ADD, is shorter length, more intense classes.
All right, Derek, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. And Mort in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Mort.
Yes, hi. My question is, how often are ADD individuals involved with reading deficiency or dyslexia, and how difficult is it to treat it with conventional reading methods like phonics?
Okay. Thanks, Mort.
It is that they are often mistaken for folks with dyslexia or learning disabilities, and this is why you want to sort of include in any evaluation at school the hypothesis of ADD, even if you rule it out, as well as other learning disabilities. And so actually the cognitive neurological processes are different for a person who is having a true reading disability. And by the way, the term dyslexia just means a reading problem. Doesn't mean you reverse letters.
Right.
It's any problem with reading. And what goes on with ADD. And if you try to solve one that and you're wrong, then it's not going to get better. And that's how you kind of figure it out sometimes.
Okay. Mort, thanks a lot for that. I'm going to call on two people now who have two different points of view about medication. First, Dan in Columbus. I'm turning to you now. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you guys? Good morning. I'm 27, and I've struggled with ADHD my whole life, along with a mild case of Asperger's. And in about the past 6 months, I've really changed up my diet. I've moved to mostly what we call real food, which is raw nuts and seeds and fruits and vegetables. I've removed gluten from my diet, which is something that I remember the doctor speaking of earlier, and as well as food dye. And I have to tell you, but after 27 years of dealing with the scatterbrainness of being Aspergian on top of not knowing the direction that I'm going because of my ADHD, the clarity that I have found in the simple adjustment to my own diet and visibly seeing and monitoring the things that I put into my body and just drinking water rather than things that have dyes and high fructose corn syrup, it's astounding to me the things that you can do if you're able to hear your own body speaking to you. And I just want to say that medication does work for the right people, but what the problem for me was that the level of medication that they had me on was almost too much to allow me to function when it was doing its job properly. And I'm talking about 102 milligrams of controlled-release Concerta.
Okay,
yeah,
well, let's hear Wes Crenshaw. Tell us.
Yeah, I wish I had a buck for every time I've heard that story. Not
wow.
Not the first part, but the over medication part. That is a third again as much as the maximum recommended dosage of
wow.
that medication. And we see this all the time. And
it begins. It has a deleterious effect at that point.
Sure, because you're getting maximum side effects, and because these medicines build tolerance. And I don't know why this is controversial to prescribers. Everybody knows stimulants build tolerance, whether they're wicked stimulants like cocaine or nicotine, or whether they are happy stimulants like caffeine. They all build tolerance. And so when you use a medication without any break, you are going to end up, as the caller did, on an excessive amount, which is going to have a deleterious effect. As for the diet, I think no one in their right mind could argue that as Americans, we on average eat a good diet. And I think regardless of whether that resolves a person's condition, whatever it may be, it's still better to enhance your health cognitively and physically by consuming a good diet, whatever you define that to be with a nutritionist. But in terms of the large-scale studies, when that has been tested as an actual treatment, it has not shown an effect. But on an individual anecdotal basis, it may well.
Dan that just called in seems really organized to me. A lot of people, just doing what he did takes a lot of thought.
Discipline.
And a lot of discipline. Yeah.
That's one of the places where the Asperger's folks can,
okay,
can benefit.
Because they can focus.
They can find an organizational, if they can find a pattern. My daughter also has that going on, and she can see all these, you know, patterns. She's going into accounting and probably a forensic accounting.
Yeah.
So she can find all these like fraudulent things. She's going to be like CSI accounting. You
know? Well, I want to call on now Tom in Columbus. You're on the air, and thanks to Dan for that call. We appreciate it. Tom, you have a different point of view. Tell us.
Hi. So I was diagnosed with ADD about 15, 20 years ago. And at the time, the medication that I was put on, Ritalin, methylphenidate, just made me, I don't know, it made me jittery, and I just didn't feel like myself. Because of what I was doing at the time in terms of, you know, occupation, I rather stayed with the disorganization than, you know, the alternative. So recently I've got myself into a situation where I'm involved in some long-term litigation that has to do with an estate. And I've gotten to a point where I'm acting as my own counsel. So I went back to see about getting back on this medication. And I was told that, you know, because I am currently either not working or going to school, that they would not prescribe me anything.
Hmm.
And then she referred me to a psychologist for some reason.
Okay. Well, Tom, thanks.
Different prescribers feel different levels of comfort with prescribing, and it ranges from 5 minutes and here is the Ritalin to I'm going to refer you to extensive neurological testing. And I don't know that that has as much to do with the experience of the patient as it does the experience of the provider. So in terms of, you know, I think what that individual will be likely to be saying is, I want you to go get an assessment from a psychologist before proceeding. We do get that quite often in our clinic. Some people would like to want to just refer to us so we can do that team model, and other people just want the assessment for refer back. So that may be what's going on there. Right. And also, as a child, medicine's going to affect you differently than it will as an adult, and you have to really look at that and see what's different now.
Tom, thanks for that call. As usual, too many calls, too many emails, not enough time. Christine Kodick, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Christine Kodick, coordinator for children and adults with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder of Columbus. We'll have a link to their website on our website at wosu.org/allsides. And Dr. Wes Crenshaw, as always, thanks for joining us.
Awesome as always, Ian.
Wes Crenshaw is a psychologist and author of the book, I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not, Successful Living with ADD and ADHD. I want to say goodbye to my intern, Khalid Moalim. Thanks so much for all your help. You've done a great job. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.